Just a quick word, first of all, about next Sunday's service. I meant to mention this earlier. Our guest speaker next Sunday will be the Reverend Diane Miller. Diane's had a very distinguished career in the Unitarian Universalist ministry. She was a minister at the UU Church of Belmont for a number of years before going to our denominational headquarters to be the chair of the Department of Ministry for several years after that. At the moment, she's the interim minister of the First Unitarian Church in Providence, Rhode Island. She'll be here next Sunday. Joyce Stewart will also lead the service with her. I'll be spending that next weekend up in Maine, tracking down a few more retired UU ministers who have some Rick Mastin stories for me for the retrospective I'm working on there. And since I'm going to be up in that neck of the woods, I decided to visit my old stomping ground church in Rockland, Maine on Sunday morning. But you'll be in very good hands with Joyce and Diane. A week ago last Tuesday, I was pleased to join with several of my UU ministerial colleagues in New Hampshire, along with a good number of other UUs and other religious liberals, not confined to Unitarian Universalists, from around the state, up in Concord to testify before the House Judiciary Committee on a proposed amendment to the New Hampshire Constitution that would define marriage in our state to be between one man and one woman exclusively. The intent, of course, is to head off even the possibility that same-sex couples in New Hampshire could ever gain legal access to legal marriage under the laws of our state. Well, the statement I made before the committee in opposition to the amendment is posted on our church website. It is not the theme of my sermon for today, except to open with this. Even in quite serious settings, I still seem to have something of the devil in me now and then. And so before the hearing was called to order, I was joshing around with some of my colleagues about what we were going to say. And trying to keep things loose, I said maybe I should offer for the committee's consideration the Kinky Friedman rationale for legalizing same-sex marriages. Who knows who I'm talking about here? All right, yeah, that's the Kinky Friedman fans out there. All right. He is, for those who don't know, a character in more ways than one. He lives in Texas. He's a singer, songwriter, author of what I guess you could called good-naturedly cynical books on contemporary American life. He's a general jokester. He's also running for governor of Texas under the slogan, "I can't make things any worse than they already are." At first, his campaign was really kind of a lark, but the response to his candidacy has been such that it is now possible that Texas just might have its own version of Minnesota's Jesse Ventura. Well, when he was interviewed, Friedman, not Ventura, when Friedman was interviewed on the Don Imus show several weeks ago, Mr. Imus asked him his position on same-sex marriage. Mr. Friedman replied, he supported it because, in his own words now, gay people should have as much of a right to be miserable as all the rest of us. Well, I decided to leave that remark on the shelf and go with my prepared text and my testimony. I can get rather cynical at times myself. I'm not quite that cynical, and neither, I suspect, is Mr. Friedman. But I'm a little intrigued, truth to tell, at the laugh that line gets whenever I use it, like it just did here. Gave me a pretty good chuckle the first time I heard it, too. And I have to wonder, is there at least just a tad of recognition in that laughter? For I would suggest that seeing humor in such a wisecrack, particularly if one is married in an ongoing committed relationship, is not because one believes their relationship is miserable, but because Friedman's words have at least a small element of reality to them. For intimate relationships, if lived with any kind of depth at all, are not, well, they're not miserable, but they can be doggone tough at times. And we know that. And that's why we laugh at a crack like Kinky Friedman makes. Another piece of humor in Friedman's punchline, now that I'm really into analyzing this whole thing, is because it serves as an antidote, I think, maybe he intended it this way, as an antidote to the often overly glorified and overly idealized image of marriage that opponents of same-sex marriage like to put forth. They seem to speak, and this was the case of some of the testimony that I heard supporting this amendment, they seem to speak as if there is this somehow abstract, inviolate, pristine entity out there somewhere called marriage that is somehow going to be trampled under, if not utterly destroyed, if couples of the same gender are given legal access to the rights and responsibilities of civil marriage. But marriage, or any kind of an ongoing committed relationship, as anybody who's been in one or is in one, you know, it is not an abstraction. It's two people. It's two human beings. Desiring and trying to make a life of it together. And doing a great and wonderful job of it sometimes. And as we know, a not so great job of it at other times. So yes, I feel that homosexual couples are just entitled to make a go of it. As are heterosexual ones. And some of those gay and lesbian couples will do a wonderful lifelong job of it. And others will probably do a lousy job of it at about the same rate, I would guess, as do those of us who are heterosexual. So can we knock off all this talk about defending some idealized abstraction called marriage and simply let those couples who want it, whatever their sexual orientation, have their fair shake at it? Seems fair enough to me. Well, I said this was not going to be a sermon on same-sex marriage, so I better move on before it becomes one. The challenge, which actually took me by surprise, that I ran into in preparing this sermon, trying to figure out where I was going to go with it after I got to this point, was trying to figure out whether I wanted to talk about love or whether I wanted to talk about marriage or ongoing relationships. Because you see, the two have not always gone together like a horse and carriage or otherwise, and for much of human history, they were not really expected to. Now, there's a lot of sources I could cite on this, but I'll very briefly make use of a single chapter in a book called The Psychology of Romantic Love, written, of course, by a psychologist, Dr. Nathaniel Brandon in this case. I really can't think of a much more unromantic title for a book than The Psychology of Romantic Love, but that seems to be the way academics like to title their work, so we'll let him do that. Anyway, this author does point out, chapter I'm referring to here, that for the most of human history, particularly Western history, from tribal societies down to the modern era, marriage and the family units they produced mostly served economic or social or political purposes. They had far more to do with the stability and the survivability of a tribe or a society or a culture than they did with the happiness or well-being of the couple involved. Among the ruling classes, monarchies, marriages were mostly a way of forging political ties or alliances between nations. Among wealthy families, particularly wealthy land-owning families at one time, they served the purpose of even further strengthening the wealth and power of wealthy and powerful families. A family wanting to combine its wealth with another family, or somebody from one family would marry somebody else, kind of like a corporate merger. A married couple, under these circumstances, any of these circumstances, they might well fall in love with each other. They might well form real bonds of affection over the course of their lives. But that would, in a way, sort of be a bonus. It wasn't really the chief end of marriage itself. Of course, there was still love. Plato knew that, but back in his time, he called it divine madness. But that love would often be sought by other means. And those means varied from one time and culture to another, and that's kind of an interesting story by itself too, but it's not where I'm going today. Let's just stay with this historical tour for another minute or two. Because it's not until we get to about the 18th or 19th century that love and marriage actually come to be joined. Because by then, we had this movement called the Enlightenment. And out of that movement came this idea that the supreme good, the summum bonum in human life, was the autonomous individual who had the right to pursue happiness in this life. Thomas Jefferson was a creature of this movement. As you know, he called such a pursuit the pursuit of happiness. He said it was an inalienable right. Wrote it right into the founding document of our nation. So it was really at about this point in human history when the pursuit of happiness became so elevated. The idea of marriage as a voluntary union between two loving individuals became the accepted, indeed the primary, focus of marriage. Now think about it. In a family, on either side of a family, say, you know, when their wedding is coming up and maybe there's some misgivings or questions on one side of the family or the other about whether this is really the right thing for the couple involved, the fallback line usually is, well, if the two of them are happy, I guess that's the main thing. Happiness. The opportunity to pursue happiness in an ongoing, loving, and committed relationship is now considered the main thing in a marriage. And I believe this is a good thing. I'll bet most, if not all of you, do too. We marry, we enter into long-term relationships for the sake of love and happiness. We wish the same for our children. But even good things, as we know, come with their challenges. And the paradoxical challenge of living and loving in an ongoing, committed relationship, whether it's given the legal sanction of marriage or not, lies in part in having to learn sort of reasonable and rational ways to live out something that is really an irrational commitment. Now, where did I get a term like irrational commitment? Well, I got it from a love poem with that same title. Love is an irrational commitment. It was written by Richard Gilbert. This is the same Richard Gilbert. He's a retired Unitarian Universalist minister. He's going to be here with us on the 26th of March, 5 Sundays from today, to help kick off our Congregational Social Justice Workshop that's going to be held on the following weekend. I hope you'll make that on your calendar. So Dick will be here. Now, within our Unitarian Universalist family, Dick Gilbert is primarily known as our social justice guy. He's the guy you get to come to workshops on various kinds of social justice issues. But he also writes a pretty good love poem. I'm not suggesting the two are mutually exclusive, by the way. In fact, loving humanity, caring about humanity, and loving another person could and should go together quite well. Anyway, here's part of this Valentine's Day poem that Dick wrote to his wife over many years. Love is an irrational commitment. Saint Valentine from long ago and far away whispered in my ear this week, away with logic, he intoned. Have done with reason for a time. Time there is enough to think and theorize. Take time to send a greeting to those you love who have given you more than you can ever give. Live in love, this irrational commitment. Laugh and laugh. Shed a tear. Remember me. Well, this poem is part of a collection of poems and meditations that Dick published many years ago. Published them under the title, Living on Paradox Drive. Now, there's a good title for you. The Paradox Drive is the road, I would say, over which most lasting relationships are traveled and lived. For if unconditional love is to stay alive, certain understandings, agreements, and conditions need to be in place. If an irrational commitment is to keep its spark, a certain amount of reasonable and rational arrangements and understandings need to be in place. If divine madness is to continue to make our life joyful, some measure of sane living needs to occur. So I guess living on Paradox Drive is kind of where it's at when it comes to living out a life of love. Because you see, nobody, I don't think, nobody makes a rational decision to fall in love. Do you? I mean, I didn't. You know? Otherwise, wouldn't you call it divine madness? Falling in love is pretty easy. It's where and how you go about things after you pick yourself up that takes the effort. And any of you who, like my wife Michelle and I have done now, have raised a son or a daughter through their adolescence into their early adulthood, you probably witnessed some of their own encounters with this divine madness kind of love. You see their giddiness. Sometimes you see the hurt that goes with it. And I got to say for myself, it's been a real mixed bag to witness all that. Still kind of ongoing. Our only son is 22 years old. It's been a real mixed bag to kind of witness all that. Because when I see that, you know, there's this wistful part of me You know, I would say, yeah, those were the days, weren't they? And then there's another part of me that says, you know, and I'm just as glad to be past them. Pick up on Thomas More again. We talk of love as if it were something within our control. We expect it to be healing and whole, and then are astonished to find it can create hollow gaps. He's talking about the risk we choose to run in an ongoing relationship in these words, once the divine madness phase is ebbed. We choose to invest of ourselves, we choose to give of ourselves in a relationship, trusting we will find and receive a good measure of wholeness and healing. What we cannot find on our own or in our singularity. And that's a risk. For the promises made, the vows exchanged, the agreements agreed upon at the outset of a relationship are also ways of acknowledging risk while saying that it's not a blind one. Yes, you may expect these things of me. I will expect these things of you. But we're taking these promises into what we both know is unknown territory on a journey down paradox track. And if that journey is going to make it, it's actually going to take more than love. Strange as that may sound at first. Several years ago, Kurt Vonnegut gave one of the major addresses in one of our Unitarian Universalist General Assemblies, and the title of his talk was Love is Too Strong a Word. I think I've used this before, but I get such a kick out of it, I don't mind taking it around the block again. Here's Vonnegut. Some of what he said. I was at the GA when he gave this talk. Love is simply too strong a word to be of much use in day-to-day relationships. Love is for Romeo and Juliet. I'm to love my neighbor? How can I do that when I'm not even speaking to my wife and kids today? My wife said to me the other day after a knockdown, drag-out fight about interior decoration, I don't love you anymore. And I said to her, so what else is new? She really didn't love me then, which was perfectly normal. She will love me some other time, I think. I hope. If she had really wanted to terminate the marriage, Vonnegut continued, to carry it past the point of no return, she would have had to say, I don't respect you anymore. Now that would be terminal. One of the many American catastrophes going on right now, along with the religious revival, is all the people getting divorced because they don't love each other anymore. That's like trading in a car when the ashtrays are full. When you don't respect your mate anymore, that's when the transmission is shut and there's a crack in the engine block. I like to think that Jesus actually said in Aramaic, ye shall respect one another. That would be a sign he really wanted to help us here on earth. Well, the spouse to which Vonnegut referred to in this address, and I think it was 20 years ago that he gave this, they're still married, still his wife to this very day, which means that respect didn't carry the day when divine madness, those times when divine madness was in short supply. And those of you who have read this man's work know that he has his own rather cynical way of expressing himself. I think he and Kinky Freeman would probably get along pretty well. But Vonnegut's also a very strong moralist. And his point, I think, beyond his sardonic language, is really a sound one. What he's saying is that love in the romantic, divine, madness sense will wax and wane. And sometimes it's wax and sometimes it's wane. But it's an underlying positive regard for it, an underlying positive valuing of the other that sustains a relationship over time. Well, let me move to a close by revisiting Thomas More one more time. Again, we always expect love to be healing and whole, and then are astonished to find it can create hollow gaps and empty failures. There's no need to dwell on this point so much as to acknowledge it. Because love addresses some of our deepest human needs, it also exposes us to some of our deepest human vulnerabilities. And that's why it's a very fine line at times that separates our being whole and our being hurt. Nobody, of course, likes being hurt or being wounded. And in a perfect world, I guess, such things would not happen. But that's not the world that any of us live in. If there's any positive message to be found, I would say, in the dealing with the pain of a failed relationship, or if the relationship has ended because of the loss of another, the pain you feel at such a time is also a very clear indication that you still have your humanity. The thing to be truly concerned about would be if you did not feel anything at all. I had the feeling, as I set out to prepare this sermon, that preparing itself was folly and madness, divine or otherwise, to try to attempt a sermon on what it means to love another person. I'm not surprised at this point that I've only scratched the surface. But there's a scene out of Woody Allen's wonderful movie, Annie Hall, that stayed with me over the many years since it was made, and I'll end with that. If you've seen the movie, maybe you remember this. It comes right at the very end of the movie, after the relationship that the Woody Allen character and the Diane Keaton as Annie Hall character, they've had it, it's come, it's gone, and they just happen to run into each other. I think on a street corner in New York, and they stand there and they do a little chit-chat for a while, talk about old times for a few minutes, and then they go on their respective ways. And Woody Allen then turns to the camera, kind of taking on the role of a narrator to the audience, and he says something like, "This whole business of love and relationships reminds me of the old joke about the two women having dinner in a Catskills resort. One of them says, 'Gee, the food here is really bad.' And the other one says, 'Yes, it is. And they serve such small portions.'" However much then love may test and try us at times, wound us at times, we're still not satisfied or happy or fulfilled if there's only a small portion of it for us. So I'd say keep yourself open to divine madness, wherever you may happen to be on your life journey, whoever you may be sharing it with, if you're sharing it with someone at this point. Do your best to build a good and lasting framework for whatever irrational commitments you make. Be aware of the vulnerability you risk in loving another, while also knowing that you give up a very vital part of living by not taking such a risk. Let's sing together in number 34, "Why Me Speak with Bravest Fire."